How many of you know the name William Carey? How many know the name William Carey? A couple. Actually, there were a couple more in the first service who knew the name William Carey. I've mentioned him to you before. He lived in the 18th century, and he is considered the father of modern missions. What we do and practice today in modern missions, as represented, for instance, by our wall in the foyer, where all our missionaries are spelled out for you. And he was the one who was the father of all of that. And he was a simple cobbler, shoemaker. But he had a heart for the world. He had a heart for the world. And he used to sit, stand by his cobbler table working on shoes. And he laid out a map of the world before him, and he would pray for the world. He has such a heart for the world. Eventually, he got to go to India and open India to the gospel and made such a difference there. But he gave up so much to do that. He gave up. There were so many things that happened in his life as a result, so many challenges in his life as a result. But he's considered the father of modern missions, who sacrificed almost everything in his life to bring the gospel to people who never heard the gospel. Now, recently I was reading, and I read this about Dr. Carey. When Dr. Carey was suffering from a dangerous illness, the inquiry was made, if this sickness should prove fatal, what passage would you select as the text for your funeral sermon? I thought that was interesting. Dr. Carey, we think you're going to die, so what text would you like at your funeral? but that's the question. And I loved his answer. I loved his answer. He replied, "Oh, I feel like such a poor, sinful creature as myself is unworthy of having anything said about him. But if a funeral sermon must be preached, let it be from the words, 'Have mercy on me, O God, according to your unfailing love, according to your great compassion, blot out my transgressions.'" Wow. A man who had accomplished all that he had accomplished, a man who had stepped out for God and sacrificed so much for God, still near the end of his life has a sense of sin, a sense of the challenges of living for God. It was said about him, in the same spirit of humility, he directed in his will that the following inscription and nothing more should be entered on his gravestone: William Carey, born August 17th, 1761, died, of course that was yet to be filled in, a wretched, poor and helpless worm, on thy kindness I fall. That's just his humility, his sense even of the greatness of sin and the greatness of what he had been forgiven just captured me. He was so cognizant of his frailty, so cognizant of his sin, even after so distinguished a life for Jesus Christ. And it just came home to me and reminded me that even the best of us are but sinners redeemed by God. Even the best of us are but sinners redeemed by God. And then I thought about Samson and about our study in Samson. And you know, it's really easy to be down on Samson. It's really easy to focus on his sin. It's really easy to focus on his failure. But to forget that even the best of us are but sinners. And though we may never have done anything as bad as what Samson did, have we ever done that in our thought life? You see, the hope to me, and what I want to leave us with this week and next week as we finish this study of Samson, the hope I want to leave us with and encouragement I want to leave us with is, Lord, if you can use Samson, you can use me. Lord, if you can use Samson, you can use me. Oswald Chambers said, in the history of God's work, you will nearly always find that it has started from the obscure, the unknown, the ignored, but the steadfastly true to Jesus Christ. Well, I think two things could be said about how to be successful to God. We must be conscious of our own sin. Conscious of our own sin, but also we must be committed to God. Now, what we're going to do this morning, we're going to divide chapter 16, which is the chapter of Samson's life that you and I usually think about. It's the one that we usually hone in on, particularly the incident with what person? Delilah. Okay, we should have Tom Jones up here singing, my, Delilah. no one could do it like him. But at any rate, we're going to focus on his sin and the warnings that he just overlooked in his life this morning. And next week, we're going to focus on his final victory. On his final victory. On your outline, it goes like this. Samson's undoing in verses 1 to 22. We're going to look at that this morning. And then next week, we'll look at his final triumph in 23 through 31. So that's where we're headed with our study. And we're going to try to answer the question finally. I raised it last time, and we're going to try to finally answer it by next week. So you got to hang in there with me, okay? Was Samson a hero, a victor, or an abject failure? Was he a hero, a victor, or an abject failure? Well, chapter 16. I want to give you a chronology here so you can understand where we're coming from. Chapters 13 through 16 of Judges covers Samson's life. Actually, from before his life. Chapter 13 starts with the angel of the Lord coming to Samson's parents and announcing that she would become pregnant, she would bear a son, this son would be a Nazirite, and God raised him up for one particular purpose. Do you remember what that is? Please. I hope that if you've forgotten everything else we studied, you remember why God raised Samson up. Do you remember? To begin to deliver Israel from the Philistines. Not to complete it, but to begin the process of delivering Israel from the Philistines. And Samson did just that. And chapter 13 covers his birth, it covers his childhood, and right up to his adulthood. Then chapters 14 and 15 cover about a year of his life. Chapters 14 and 15 is where he marries a Philistine girl, and I won't get into all that followed that, but chapters 14 and 15 talk about his marrying the Philistine girl and the aftermath of that, and the way that provided a way for him to begin the confrontation against the Philistines. That chapters 14 and 15 cover about a year of his life. Chapter 15, verse 20 ends with these words, Samson led Israel for 20 years in the days of the Philistines. So we believe that we have chapter 13, his birth, right up to his adulthood. Chapters 14 and 15 cover about a year of his life, his marriage, the aftermath of that. Then he had a 20-year ministry as a judge over Israel. And we're going to see as we get into chapter 16, the things that he did in his life in 14, 15, and that 20 years of his judgeship really set the Philistines on edge. Because he did what God set him apart to do. He began the deliverance from the Philistines. That brings us to chapter 16, which most believe follows his 20-year ministry and concludes his 20-year ministry. And chapter 16 takes just a little less than a year in his life. So that's the chronology of what we've been studying. Let's look at verses 1 to 3. We see the first in chapter 16, but another in Samson's many failures, turning away from God. One day Samson went to Gaza. Now it's important to understand, Gaza was an important Philistine city, maybe the most important of the Philistine cities. There were five major cities that made up Philistia, and there were five rulers, and we'll read about them later in this chapter. There were five rulers of the Philistines. Gaza was an important city, if not the most important city, and that's where Samson goes. That's 35 miles southwest of his home in Zora, and it's 3 miles from the Mediterranean Sea. So that kind of gives you the geography here. We're not told why he went, but we are told that he saw a prostitute and he went in to spend the night with her. Now, another of these times when we just, you know, wonder, Samson, what's going on in your mind? What are you thinking? Why are you choosing this path in your life? Well, the people of Gaza were told, Samson is here. So they surrounded the place and lay in wait for him all night at the city gate. They made no move during the night, saying, at dawn, we'll kill him. So again, we're not told why he went to the city, but he spent the night with a prostitute. The Philistines discover he's there. And by the way, I think they were keeping tabs on him. He had already confronted them several times. It had already cost them many Philistine lives because he was one among all of the Israelites who did not compromise with them, who did not compromise his faith, who did not compromise his life, who did not compromise and become a worshiper of Dagon, their false god. I think they kept an eye on him. And they find out he's in the city, and they wait for him all night at the city gate. They felt secure. This is great. They felt secure. We're at the gate's closed, the bar's on the gate. He's not going to get out. We don't have to worry about it. We can just go to the city gate. We'll take a little snooze, get our rest, and in the morning we'll capture him. So that's what their thinking is. Now, interestingly, we see here an example of the results of his confronting the Philistines and their animosity toward him as the leader of Israel and as one who wouldn't bow to them. Well, verse 3, Samson lay there only until the middle of the night. Then he got up and took hold of the doors of the city gate together with the two posts. He tore them loose, bar and all. He lifted them to his shoulders and carried them to the top of the hill that faces Hebron. Now, archaeology has helped us out here because we found similar gates. And what we find is that this gate would have been 13 to 14 feet wide. Pretty wide. It would have been about 3 1/3 feet thick, 9.9 feet high. We learned this from archaeological findings, 9.9 feet high, and weighed 10,696 pounds. Whoa. Now there's a weightlifter, right? 10,696 pounds. If the bar and the bronze plating is added, it would double the weight. So it would be about 20,000 pounds, about 10 tons is what this weighed. Samson, now this is what's so great. This is the symbol of their security. And Samson just picks it up and carries it. Now, it's not clear in the text when it says that he carried it, he lifted them to his shoulders and carried them to the top of the hill that faces Hebron. It's not clear if this hill was outside Gaza and he carried it up a hill outside Gaza that faced the city of Hebron, which was 37 miles away, or it could possibly mean he carried 20,000 pounds for 37 miles. We just don't know for sure, to a hill that was just outside Hebron. But once again, this shows the superior might of Samson's God. Once again, it shows the victory of Samson's God over the false god Dagon that the Philistines worshipped. Now, there's something that we don't see in Judges 16, verses 1 to 3. What is missing that we've seen before in Samson's life? Anybody want to take a wild guess? The Spirit of the Lord. The Spirit of the Lord. Up till this point, we've seen the Spirit of the Lord prompting Samson, the Spirit of the Lord strengthening Samson, the Spirit of the Lord directing Samson. We don't see that at all here. We don't see the Spirit of the Lord. In fact, we're not going to see the Spirit of the Lord again in Samson's life till the end of the chapter and his restoration. We're not going to see the Spirit of the Lord again in his life until the end of the chapter and his restoration. Well, verse 4 begins the section that probably most of us are most familiar with, and that concerns Delilah. Verse 4, sometime later, and we're not told how long, he fell in love with a woman in the valley of Sorek whose name was Delilah. Now, this is something interesting, I think, about Delilah. Her name is Semitic. Her name is Semitic. So it's not entirely clear whether she was a Philistine or whether she was an Israelite who was part of the compromisers. She may very well have been an Israelite since Delilah is a Semitic name. But we don't know that. Either way, as one writer said, she had the heart of a Philistine. She had the heart of a Philistine. She was definitely, if nothing more, if she wasn't a Philistine herself, she was definitely under the influence of the Philistines. And if an Israelite, she was one of the compromisers. Because we're going to see as we go through this passage, she works with the five rulers of the Philistines to find the secret of Samson's strength. Because they thought that the secret of his strength was some kind of magic. They still didn't understand about Yahweh. They still didn't understand about God. And they thought they could find the secret, some kind of magic that made him strong as he was. Well, the rulers of the Philistines went to her and said, "See if you can lure him into showing you the secret of his great strength and how we can overpower him so that we may tie him up and subdue him. Each one of us will give you 1,100 shekels of silver." Now, in other words, each of one of them would give her 28 pounds of silver, which would amount to several thousands of dollars. It would be a huge amount for Delilah in that day. That's how much they want to get rid of Samson. That's how much trouble he has caused them. That's how much he has fulfilled God's purpose in his life to confront the Philistines and to begin the deliverance of the Israelites from the Philistines. Thousands upon thousands of dollars. So Delilah takes the challenge. She just wants the money. And so she makes four attempts to learn his secret. The first three, as you know, unsuccessful. The last one, only two successful. But this is what is fascinating here, is that he seems oblivious to what she's doing. She nags him and nags him and nags him. "Tell me the secret of your strength. If you don't tell me the secret, you don't love me," blah, blah, all that stuff. And he lies to her. But what I want you to see is that every lie gets closer to the truth. Every lie gets closer to the truth. And she nags him, and he's oblivious because he gives her an answer. "This is what you can do that will make me lose my strength." So she does it, and then she says, "Samson, the Philistines are upon you." Now, I don't know, did he think she was teasing him? Apparently, the Philistines in each case were in an adjoining room just waiting to get Samson. But he seems oblivious to her attempts. Why is that? I think it's possible to see that sin has made him insensitive. Sin and desire has made him insensitive to his vulnerability and insensitive to the consequences to his life, spiritual and otherwise. Sin can do that to us, folks. And if you get nothing more from today, what I want to communicate is you and I have to have a strategy to deal with sin in our lives. You and I have to have a strategy to deal with desire in our lives. Whether you are single or whether you are married, we need a strategy. We need fences in our lives to protect us, to understand. You can't play with sin. You can't play with desire. You can't play with lust. Can't play with those things. Samson played with them and he paid a high price. You and I can't trifle with sin. And that's what Samson did. He trifled with sin. He trifled with God's purpose for his life. Well, the first attempt is in verses 6 to 9. So Delilah said to Samson, "Tell me the secret of your great strength, and how you can be tied up and subdued." Samson answered her, "If anyone ties me with 7 fresh thongs that have not been dried, I'll become as weak as any other man." Then the rulers of the Philistines brought her 7 fresh thongs that had not been dried. She tied him with them. With men hidden in the room, she called to him, "Samson, the Philistines are upon you." But he snapped the thongs as easily as a piece of string snaps when it comes close to a flame, so the secret of his strength was not discovered. These 7 fresh thongs were bowstrings that were made from animals' intestines. That's what they were. Once again, did he not realize what was happening? Did he think that somehow she was teasing him or playing around? Is that what he thought? We don't know, but he keeps this up. Verses 10 to 12 is the second attempt. Then Delilah said to Samson, "You've made a fool of me. You lied to me. Come now, tell me how you can be tied." He said, "If anyone ties me securely with new ropes that have never been used, I'll become as weak as any other man." So Delilah took new ropes, tied him with them. Then with men hidden in the room, she called to him, "Samson, the Philistines are upon you." But he snapped the ropes off his arms as if they were threads. New ropes are ropes that have never been used. They'd be the strongest ropes. But as we've already seen from chapter 15, verses 13 and 14, new ropes aren't going to hold him. The men of Judah tied him with new ropes. And when the Philistines attacked him, he broke them as easily as if they were old, worn-out ropes. Verses 13 to 14, his third attempt. Delilah then said to Samson, "Until now you've been making a fool of me and lying to me. Tell me how you can be tied." Now, don't you think by the third time he ought to say to himself, this seems rather odd. What's going on? So she said, "You've been making a fool out of me, lying to me. Tell me how you can be tied." Excuse me. I just love allergies. He replied, "If you weave the 7 braids of my head into the fabric on the loom and tighten it with the pin, I'll become as weak as any other man." Now he's getting a little closer to the truth. He is really flying close to the flame, isn't he? He's really playing with fire here and doesn't realize what's going on. So while he was sleeping, Delilah took the 7 braids of his head, wove them into the fabric, and tightened it with the pin. Again, she called to him, "Samson, the Philistines are upon you." He awoke from his sleep, pulled up the pin and the loom with the fabric. Once again, he doesn't seem to know what's going on. He doesn't seem to understand, but he's getting a little closer to the truth. The fourth attempt, and this is the successful attempt, is in verses 15 to 20. In verse 15 we read, "Then she said to him, 'How can you say I love you when you won't confide in me? This is the third time you've made a fool of me and haven't told me the secret of your great strength.' With such nagging, she prodded him day after day until he was tired to death." You can fill in your own joke here. Okay. Day after day, she nagged him and prodded him until he was tired to death. So he told her, verse 17, he told her everything. "No razor has ever been used on my head." Why is that? Because he was a Nazarite. His mother was told, and then his father later was told, that he would be a Nazarite from his birth. That no razor should ever touch his head. And along with the other regulations for the Nazarite having to do with grapes, raisins, wine, grape juice, being near a dead body, some things that he was very cavalier about earlier in his life. But the one thing he was never cavalier about in his life, as far as we have seen in the text in the scripture, is his hair. Apparently, his hair for all his life has never been cut, ever. And there's something else to keep in mind here. According to number 6, which lays out the regulations for the Nazarite, the sign of consecration to God, of all the regulations of the Nazarite, the one regulation that was a sign of dedication to God, that was a sign of consecration to God, was letting the hair uncut. Samson's really playing with fire now. And he doesn't realize what danger he's in. We're going to see in a moment, as we try to draw this together, that happens to you and to me when we play with fire, when we play with temptation, when we allow lust. We're going to pay a price, even as Samson's going to pay a mighty price in his life. He said, "Because I have been a Nazarite set apart to God from birth, if my head were shaved, my strength would leave me, and I would become as weak as any other man." When Delilah saw that he had told her everything, she sent word to the rulers of the Philistines, "Come back once more. He has told me everything." So the rulers of the Philistines returned with the silver in their hands. Having put him to sleep on her lap, she called a man to shave off the 7 braids of his hair, and so began to subdue him, and his strength left him. Then she called, "Samson, the Philistines are upon you." He awoke from the sleep and thought, "I'll go out as before and shake myself free." But he did not know that the Lord had left him. Now, we won't get into that today. We'll get into it next week. But that's one of the saddest phrases in all of the Bible. That is one of the saddest phrases in all of the Bible. He did not know that the Lord had left him. He finally tells her everything. His strength was in his hair. But we know that his strength wasn't literally in his hair, because it wasn't some kind of magic. His hair was the symbol of his consecration to God. His hair was the symbol above every other Nazarite qualification or regulation. His hair was the sign that he was committed to God. When he carelessly let her know that truth and his head was shaved, he lost his strength. He lost his strength. It's not clear in the text if he understood or really believed that his strength would leave him, but it is clear that he took the Lord for granted and he took God's presence in his life for granted. And that's what makes this story so sad. And he enters a sleep of false security. One writer said, Satan ruins men by rocking them to sleep. You and I must not be lulled to sleep by sin. Have to keep alert, keep awake, wide awake to the power of sin, wide awake to the power of lust, wide awake to the power of desire. We have to be careful. We have to make provision in our lives. We can't just think, well, I'll be okay. Or we'll find ourselves in Samson's position. The importance of his hair was that it, not that his strength was in the hair, but that it symbolized his dedication to God. And when he let her in on the secret, it's as if he was saying, my dedication to God's not important anymore. How did that happen in his life? How did it come? Because he allowed desire, he allowed lust, he allowed sin to be a controlling factor in his life. Despite Samson's failures, his usefulness to God was defined by his obedience to the Nazarite vow. It was symbolized, which was symbolized by his uncut hair. The defining aspect of his life was his hair, because it symbolized his commitment to God. One writer put it this way, the real reason for Samson's power was that God was with him and had chosen him to deliver the Israelite people from the Philistines. Another writer said, one obvious lesson that we can learn from his story, however, is that it is fatal to toy with temptation. The final disclosure to the Delilah of the true secret of his amazing strength was preceded by three false explanations. Apart from being untruths, these teasing inventions reveal that all the time he was at least playing with the idea of telling her what she wanted to know. The moment he even considered the possibility of revealing his secret, he was well on the way to defeat. And then the writer says this, and I think that we must take this seriously. It is imperative to run away from temptation, not to trifle with it. It is imperative to run away from temptation, not to trifle with it. This is a cautionary tale. This is a warning to you and a warning to me that we must have those boundaries. We must have those fences set up to protect us. We must not believe the lies of Satan. Another writer said, Samson thought playing with Delilah was a game. It turned out to be Russian roulette, and he bought the bullet. You cannot trifle with sin in your life. If you're like Samson, flirting with a Delilah, believing that you can keep sin in bounds, let me warn you that you're playing with a lion. You may stick your head in its mouth once and get away with it, even twice and three times. Samson did, but one of these times, that lion will shut its mouth, and you will lose your head once and for all. It's a warning to us, folks. It's a warning to us not to trifle with sin. It's a warning to us not to trifle with our commitment to God, with our consecration to God. One of the classic writings on temptation was by Dietrich Bonhoeffer, who said this, in our members there is a slumbering inclination towards desire which is both sudden and fierce. With irresistible power, desire seizes mastery over the flesh. All at once, a secret smoldering fire is kindled. The flesh burns and is in flames. It makes no difference whether it is sexual desire or ambition or vanity or desire for revenge or love of fame and power or greed for money or finally that strange desire for the beauty of the world of nature. Joy in God is extinguished in us, and we seek all our joy in the creature. That is, we ignore God, we ignore His will for us, and we embrace the lie. We embrace the lie. At this moment, God is quite unreal to us. He loses all reality, and only desire for the creature is real. The only reality is the devil. Satan does not here fill us with hatred of God, but with forgetfulness of God. Oh, that's such a good line. Satan doesn't fill us with hatred for God. He fills us with forgetfulness of God. We forget God. That's what Samson did. He forgot God. And now his falsehood, Satan's falsehood, is added to this proof of strength. The lust that thus aroused envelops the mind and will of man in deepest darkness. The powers of clear discrimination and of decision are taken from us. The questions present themselves: is what the flesh desires really sin in this case? Is it really not permitted to me? Is it really not expected of me? In other words, Satan takes us to the place where desire is inflamed, we forget about God, and then we justify our sin. Well, how can it be sin? God made me with this desire. How can it be sin? God made me want that. How can this be sin? God made me. That's the argument of the Corinthians in 1 Corinthians 6. Paul has a fantastic argument about immorality in 1 Corinthians 6. Where he quotes a proverb of the day which said, the stomach for food and food for the stomach. The meaning of it is this: eating is just a biological process. Eating is just a biological process, so therefore eat. But the Corinthians, the Greeks, were using the proverb to say that sex is just another biological urge. It's just another biological process. It doesn't hurt you to engage in immorality. And Paul's answer is, to sin against your own body is to sin against God. To sin against your own body is to sin against God. See, we forget God. Desires inflame, we forget God, and then we begin to question, is it really wrong? Is it really something I shouldn't do? So let me ask you this, what are the hedges in your life? What are the hedges in your life? What are the boundaries you have set up in your life to protect you, especially in this matter of desire? Especially in the matter of lust. You and I have got to have boundaries. I hope that if you don't know what your boundaries are, I hope you'll take some time, maybe later today or sometime this week, to think through, what are the boundaries I have placed in my life to protect me from the kind of failure that Samson is guilty of? If you're married, let me make a couple suggestions. Number one, never share intimate details of your life or your marriage with another woman other than your wife, or if you're the wife, another man other than your husband. Never share intimate details of your life with a person of the opposite sex. Never. There is built a bond. There is built a friendship. A door is opened. So never share intimate details of your marriage. If you're having difficulty, go to your pastor, go to a counselor. Go to somebody who is a real friend. And by the way, you got to be careful about that. That sometimes backfires big time. But don't share intimate details of your life with a person of the opposite sex. Except for work responsibilities, and I know that many of you have work responsibilities, but except for work responsibilities, do not spend time alone with a man or a woman who's not your husband or wife. In work, you have to. That's okay. We work side by side. There's nothing wrong with that. But except for those work responsibilities, don't spend especially large amounts of time alone where the man or a woman is not your husband or wife. A man I'm greatly respected, a good friend of mine, and I'm going back a long, long, long time. This is before my time in Del Rio. Called me one day and had to confess that he was in a phone relationship with a woman other than his wife. And it wasn't sex. You know, it wasn't one of these kinds of calls. They just struck up a friendship and they spent hours on the phone talking to each other. Except for work responsibilities, do not spend time, especially large amounts of time, alone with a man or a woman who's not your husband or wife. If you find yourself attracted to another person, then you've got to think about, how can I vary my routine so I'm not always running into that person? You know how it works, right? You feel an attraction to somebody, and sometimes, somehow, you find yourself always where you know they're going to be. That's playing with fire. That's playing with fire. So you think about it and you think, okay, I'm attracted to that person. I'm going to have to put up hedges. I'm going to have to put up boundaries. I'm going to have to put up fences. And one fence is to vary my routine, vary your routine so you don't run into them accidentally. Those are just some ideas. I hope that's a starter list for you. If you're single, not married yet, you still have to watch. Immorality is accepted in our society as okay. Buying into the 1 Corinthians 6 view of sexuality. What are some fences for a single? Well, some fences is watch what websites you go to. Watch what websites you go to. Watch your social media. And especially, don't buy into the philosophy of the world that says it's okay. Don't buy into that philosophy. Rather, make your commitment, the most important commitment in your life, be your commitment to God. Let me just illustrate real quickly, and we're going to be done, and we'll get into, it's kind of negative today, I know, I'm sorry. You know, sin is negative, right? I'm sorry, I can't paint it in pretty colors. Next week, we'll see the restoration of Samson, so hang in there, folks, it's coming. Roger and Becky Terabasi wrote a book called How to Live With Them Since You Can't Live Without Them. I've mentioned the book to you many times. I love that book. It's out of print now, so you have to go to Amazon or whatever website you get your used books from and order it. For a couple bucks, you'll get the best book, one of the best books you ever read, especially if you're married or if you're looking toward marriage. How to Live With Them Since You Can't Live Without Them. In one of their chapters on staying connected to each other, they wrote this. Early in our marriage, and I can't exactly remember when, Roger and I discussed the fact that we needed to avoid having friends of the opposite sex with whom we would meet in private. In 20 years, we've had many friends, both singles and couples, with whom we've socialized, but rarely have we met with these people in private. We enjoy friends and co-workers of the same and opposite sex, but to protect our relationship physically and emotionally, we decided not to confide in our friends or co-workers who are of the opposite sex regarding our marital relationship. We have taken this approach so that we avoid opening any intimate emotional doors, setting wrong or inappropriate thoughts in motion, or compromising our relationship in any way. A number of women have been Roger's secretary, and I have been on traveling speaking teams with men, but if or when either of us felt threatened or concerned, we shared our feelings and discussed additional boundaries that might be helpful to protect us. These types of decisions carry some feelings of resistance, but the benefits surpass the negative feelings. Just let me close with this. I hope if you have not thought about the boundaries, the fences in your life, that you'll take some time today, this week, and think about what they are and what you need to protect yourself so you don't fall like Samson. Let's bow in prayer. Father, thank you. Thank you that from this negative example of Samson's life, we can gain positive understanding. Help us to not easily abandon our commitment to you, our commitment to holiness, but help us to follow you. Help us to think through those things that will help us not to fail and not to fall. Pray these things in Jesus' name. Amen.